Good evening, my name is Bob Garrell and I am an alcoholic.
Hi, Bob.
Would you join me in a moment of silence while we open with a prayer? Lord, help me to set aside everything I think I know about you, everything I think I know about myself, everything I think I know about others, and everything I think I know about my own recovery, all for a new experience in you, Lord, a new experience in myself, a new experience in my fellows, and a much needed new experience in my own recovery. Amen. My name's Bob. I'm an alcoholic. I've been through the process of this book. Good sponsorship and a commitment that's been consistent, persistent to the primary purpose of helping drunks. I haven't had a drink or any mind or emotion altering substance since October 31st, 1978. And that is not my doing, it's the doing of the power, comes from the power of Alcoholics Anonymous in my life. What we're going to do this weekend is we're going to try to go through some of this book and share our experience. That's really the most powerful thing we have. We're not here to teach anybody anything or instruct anybody. Or if you're doing stuff differently than what stuff we cover, that's fine. This is all about our experience with this book. If it's useful, that's great. My hope is that there might be some new people here that something this weekend they'll connect with that might light a fire under them to get into some of this stuff and maybe also to pass it on to others. Another hope I always have in Alcoholics Anonymous, we lose a lot of our old-timers. The guys that are sober 10, 15, 20, 25, 30 years. They fall between the cracks. We're getting an unusual large amount of them that are drinking again, committing suicide. And when we have a newcomer that's not doing very well, we circle the wagons around him. If you're sober 20 years and you seem depressed, well, you're 20 years sober, screw you, you're on your own. I mean, and it's not really that way, but that it seems to come off that way sometimes. Don't, if you're new, please don't take this the wrong way. If you drink again, we hope you never do. Statistically, your chances of coming back and finding lifelong sobriety are fairly high. You may die, but a guy with 25 years, his chances of coming back and getting lifelong sobriety are a lot slimmer. So my hope is, every time we do a weekend like this, there's always some guy in the room, 25, 20, 15 years sober, that's out here and doesn't even know it, and then all of a sudden something will happen this weekend, and he'll start coming back to the center of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'll tell you, when I hear about that happening, it almost brings tears to my eyes that God might have used me, because it's nothing I would say. I think we're just, at our best, we're instruments here. And so I hope to be an instrument. I want to introduce to you an old dear friend of mine. I'm not old in the chronological sense, old in the fact that we've known each other for a while, Katie.
Hi, everyone. I'm Katie Parker. I'm a grateful recovered alcoholic. I've had the gift of sobriety since October the 28th. We're both Halloween babies of 84. It was obviously a good Halloween, wasn't it? First of all, it's quite an honor to be up here with Bob. Bob has been, I know that we say we have no heroes in AA. Well, I have heroes in AA, and Bob is one of them, and he's a very dear friend of mine, and I'm very honored that he's asked me to be in this chair, which I feel 100% confident that I can be in this chair. And that's a good feeling today, because when Bob was talking about the people with long-term sobriety that are sitting in these rooms that are dying of untreated alcoholism, I was one of them. And 7 years ago, my choice was to either die or to drink. And that was 17 years sober, 15, 17 years sober. And today, the life that I have, I hope if you're sitting in these rooms and you're kind of just ho-hum, long-term sobriety, I say long-term is usually over 8, 10, 12 years, and your program's just okay, I believe these weekends are so gifted in guiding you, completely altering your program. And that was my experience, is the set-aside prayer that Bob did moments ago is one of the most wonderful prayers in the world, because I've got an incredible ego and I've got a know-it-all-ism that's unbelievable. And if I know it, thank you very much. I've got it highlighted and underlined. And the truth is, you know, God, please help me see a new experience here. And I just have to say that today, when I apply all 12 steps as they're laid out in the book for me, my life was rocketed into the fourth dimension in something I never understood before. It absolutely wasn't anything I knew. So I hope you have the same experience. I believe that you're here because you showed up, but there's a way bigger picture happening. At least that was my experience at the last big book study I went to 7 years ago, and then found out, as much as it rocked my world, I began to realize that it altered my recovery program from that day forward. And my life today is fantastic. It's not without problems. I don't know where I came up with thinking it would be without problems, but it's not without problems. But the level of peace of mind in the midst of the storm is wonderful. So thank you, and thanks, Bob, for asking me.
Well, in case anybody's wondering, Katie was talking about her life's not without problems, and if you're curious about what that's about, I'd like to introduce you to Charlie, Katie's husband.
Call him one.
It was a great member of AA, and I'm delighted he came along with Katie. So, where's a good place to start, I guess, would be step one, which I think is possibly the hardest thing an alcoholic will ever do. Matter of fact, it's so crucial and yet so difficult. In this day and age, it kills most of us. This inability to fully concede to our innermost selves. And yet, most of us go to meetings, as I did for years back in the 70s, and relapse periodically, and I could easily say I was an alcoholic. If you put the spotlight on me, I'd tell you I was powerless over alcohol. And I got to tell you, I don't think I even understood what I was saying. I'm the kind of guy that I just want to fit. So I'll pretty much say anything, you know, but I don't know what I'm talking about. So what does it mean when you say you're powerless over alcohol? What does it mean when you say you're an alcoholic? Well, let's start taking a look at what the book says and try to match it up personally with some of the reality of our personal experience. If you go to the doctor's opinion, I'm working out of a fourth edition. If you have a third edition, the pages are going to be off, I think, two. But on the fourth edition of the doctor's opinion, in Roman numeral XXVIII, which is secretly the alcoholic's theme song, III. Dr. Silkworth, this amazing psychiatrist, neurologist, and medical doctor who worked at Towns Hospital, Knickerbocker Hospital in New York City for most of his life, he dedicated to helping people like us. And he made some conclusions that were just right on the money. He drew some medical conclusions based on observation of thousands of us that later were proved absolutely correct as they started to analyze the brain chemistry of the alcoholic. But that's interesting intellectually. We want to try to state an experience. And Silkworth says at the top of the page, he says, we believe, and so suggested a few years ago, that the action of alcohol on these chronic alcoholics is a manifestation of an allergy. that the phenomenon of craving is limited to this class and never occurs in the average temperate drinker.
Well, that's a lot of words. What does that mean?
Well, first he's talking about something that's interesting. He's talking about a type of alcohol. A chronic alcohol. And I believe from observation, and also from what it talks about in the book on page 20 and 21, that there are chronic and acute alcoholics. And just like any other disease, you have your acute illnesses, which can be deadly. Pneumonia is an acute illness. You got pneumonia, it can kill you. But if you get to a hospital, you get to the right doctor, he's going to load you up on an appropriate antibiotic for a period of time, and they're going to knock that pneumonia out once and for all. You're good to go. That's your done. No more pneumonia. End of problem. But chronic illnesses such as diabetes, alcoholism, certain types of heart conditions, heart disease, the physical stabilization of the condition is but the beginning of a lifetime regimen of recovery. And that's the kind of alcoholic I am. I am an alcoholic of the chronic variety. I didn't want to be. I wanted to be the guy that just could make up his mind that I shouldn't drink anymore, no drugs either, just not going to do nothing, and be good to go. As if the physiological stabilization of my condition was the answer. But I'm just curious, just a show of hands, how many people in this room, besides myself, ever once got to a point where you knew that this drinking is killing you and you swore to yourself and meant it that you're never going to touch that stuff again and then got drunk after that? The one or two that didn't raise their hand are Al-Anons. They're here. Well, that's a pretty universal thing in alcoholism. The stabilization of the condition physically eventually drives us insane. So insane that the stuff that we swore we'd never do, like a moth to a flame. And we're going to start looking at why that is. But more importantly, at this point, Silkworth says that the action of alcohol on guys like me is a manifestation of an allergy. Now, I remember being in treatment in the mid-70s, listening to people talk about this allergy. I don't get it. I know a little bit about allergies. I have a mild allergy to cats. After about an hour being around cats, my eyes start to itch and water. My nose starts to stuff up a little bit. If it's real bad, after a long enough period of time, I might even get a little tightness in my chest. But when I drink alcohol, none of that happens. I don't see an allergy. But the manifestation of the allergy in alcoholics to alcohol isn't like a manifestation to an allergy to cats. Silkworth refers to it as a phenomenon of craving. And he says that this allergic reaction, this phenomenon of craving that happens once I induce alcohol into the system of an alcoholic, into me, never occurs in the average temperate drinker. Well, I remember sitting in a treatment center in probably 1976, 75 or 6, and listening to someone talk about this phenomenon of craving. And I don't get it. I get that I'm in trouble. I get that I drink and sometimes do bizarre things. I get that I have a tendency to go a little too far, but some of the guys I drink with go a little too far too. But I can't identify experiencing a clawing of the walls, a craving for alcohol. And the reason is like all cravings, you do not know you have it unless you can't satisfy it. Everyone in this room, right this second, is in the grip of a craving you're not even aware of. And that's the craving to breathe air. If someone were to sneak up behind you with a plastic bag and put it over your face, you would instantly realize you have a craving to breathe air because you can't satisfy it anymore. As long as you're satisfied, you don't even realize it's there. And alcohol, the craving for alcohol is very much like that. As long as I can satisfy it, and what happens is intuitively, now not because I think I'm alcoholic, intuitively I will avoid situations where I can only get two or three drinks. Now, I don't do that because I think I'm alcoholic. I remember junior high school going to a guy's house, and there was three of us there. He had a six-pack of beer for the whole day, Sunday afternoon, for three of us, and there's no way to get any more. Do you know what I did? I passed. No, thank you. Now, if he'd had five or six cases, I'm right there with you. Now, I don't do that because I think I'm alcoholic. I'm going to get two beers. To me, it's like, what's the point? I mean, what's the point? Right? Now, so it was hard for me to identify the phenomenon of craving because I always seemed to maneuver a way to satisfy it. And then what happened to me was I was sitting in a meeting in the 70s and I was listening to a woman share her experience about going to a dinner party. And when she shared this, the light went on. And all of a sudden I could remember something that had happened to me when I was 18 years old. And what I remembered, when I was 18 years old, I was dating a gal, and she wanted me to come and spend the whole evening at her house and meet her family, her mom and dad, and get to know them. And I went, trying to be a good guy like this girl. And I remember that I always had sober, I always had an awkwardness about me around people. I kind of hid pretty good, but I always felt it very, very much in here. And I'm going, trying to be a good guy, a little self-conscious, because I feel like they put me under the microscope a little bit, you know. And now, I want you to know, when I was 18 years old, you could have put me on a lie detector and asked me, Bob, is there any way in the world you could possibly be alcoholic? And I'm absolutely convinced I would have said no, and the lie detector would have said I was telling the truth. But I had alcoholism at that point just as much as I have it today, just as much as I had it when I was thrown out of the halfway house and I'm in the park drinking Richard's Wild Irish Rose. But I didn't know it. But I'm going through, at 18 years old, I'm going through my better living through chemistry phase of my alcoholism. Right? But alcoholism doesn't care if you do other drugs. Alcoholism doesn't care if you have long hair and you're a rock and roll star or wannabe. It doesn't care even if you don't think you have it. If you got it, you got it. And I had it. And I go into this deal with these people that want to meet me, and we sit down at the dinner table for dinner, and they bring out a bottle of wine. Not the kind of bottle of wine any of us would buy. This is a little wimpy Al-Anon kind of bottle of wine. And they pour us all a glass of this wine, some kind, not even the kind of wine we would buy. This wine had a cork. Probably 11% alcohol. Ah, I like that 20% stuff that never saw a grape. But it's something like Blue Nun or something like that, you know, and they pour us a glass of this wine. So, I've always drank quickly. I don't know why. Evaporation may be a childhood issue of mine. I don't know. Because I drink quickly, I've killed two glasses out of that bottle of wine. They're still sipping on the first glass, and the bottle's dead. And I'm sitting there, and I'm 18 years old. I don't know nothing about alcoholism, but I've got two glasses of wine in me, and I'm stuck there for the rest of the night. And I'm sitting at that dinner table, and their conversation, which earlier was a little sort of mildly interesting, now is becoming irritating. And I don't know what's wrong. I'm antsy. I'm squirrely. And I finally said to him, I said, you know, God, that was good wine. Do you have any more? And they said, no. And they went back to talking about sports in Vietnam and all this other kind of crap. And I'm sitting there and I'm thinking, I'm going to lose my mind. You know how you talk to yourself in your head? Well, it's getting a little panicky in here. And I finally blurted out, I said, you know, I sure like beer. And they said, we don't have any beer. Bob, next time you come over, we'll get you a six-pack of beer. They went back to talking. And I'm sitting there like, I'm going nuts. And I finally excused myself. I went to their bathroom. I locked the door like a crazy person. I rummaged through their cabinets and medicine chests until I found a bottle of cough medicine, which was 35% alcohol, with codeine and turpentine, which is a bonus.
Mm-hmm.
Sat on the edge of that bathtub and chugged that bottle of cough medicine. You know, it spun into my head. It just went, boom. And it all got slowed down. And I was able to sit there and focus. I was able to sit there and come up with a plan. And I went back out to that dinner table and I explained to those people about this thing I forgot to take care of that was very important. Made up some kind of story. Can't tell you what it was today. They were very nice about it. I said, I'm sorry I have to go. And they were sorry. And I went out and I got in my car. I drove down their street 25 miles an hour like you're supposed to. Turned the corner, got out of sight, and drove like a crazy person, probably 75, 80 miles an hour, to get to a friend of mine's house who had an open bar in the basement and some tie stick, which is a bonus, because I'd had two glasses of wine. And it lit something up inside of me, what Silkworth calls an allergic reaction to alcohol. And he says it only occurs in us and never occurs in the average temperate drinker. Do you know that those other people at that dinner table, if they'd have been alcoholic, we'd all been in that bathroom going through those cabinets.
Yeah.
But it doesn't happen to anybody except me. You know, they ask you, this was so confusing for me. Because I would go time and time, I'd end up in treatment center. After treatment center, and I was an alcoholic in the days where on the streets, man, you just do anything. Alcohol was primary, but there was a lot of other stuff in the mix. And they'd ask me at a treatment center as I'm checking in, they'd say, what's your drug of choice? Wow. What do you got? I mean, I don't know. I drank vanilla extract a couple times. I mean, in jail one time, I broke open a magic marker and huffed it just hoping something would happen. You know what I mean? I mean, what's my drug of choice? Wrong question. Here's the question is, Bob, what happens to you when you drink alcohol? Bob, have you ever, that you can remember, with any kind of consistency, ever been drinking and drink to a point where you're satisfied? In all your drinking, Bob, do you ever remember times where you're drinking with your buddies for an hour or so and have the bartender come by and say, Bob, you ready for another drink? Do you ever, Bob, remember sitting there legitimately and honestly thinking to yourself, not because the heat's on or people, nothing, but just really think to yourself, no, you know, this is just right. No, thank you. I've never had that experience once. It's always one more, one more, one more. Matter of fact, I'm the guy that, if I'm still conscious, I ain't done drinking. I'm going up to Boston in a couple weeks, in March, to do some stuff up there. And I'm going to go visit this one place. I was up there. I went up there with a bunch of guys on spring break one time and went to this party, and we heard about this party that was supposed to be really awesome up in Boston. There was all from BU and all the schools, and you know, all these guys had this big party. And we went up there and it was an amazing party. And we're doing shots and we're smoking reefer and drinking wine and all kinds of stuff. And a guy came through the party with a bunch of capsules. And looking back, oddly enough, I didn't even ask him what they were. I just said, thank you. Took a bunch of them. And they turned out to be animal tranquilizers. Well, in about an hour, I'm laying on the floor, and I can't get up, but I'm still awake, so I'm laying there trying to talk people into bringing me drinks, right? Because of a phenomenon of craving, because I'm still conscious, and if I'm still conscious, I ain't done drinking. This never occurs in the average temperate drinker. You want to learn a little bit about your alcoholism? Watch a non-alcoholic drink. My sister is not an alcoholic. I watch my sister drink a lot. We go out to dinner once a week. And sometimes my sister will have a drink, sometimes she won't. And I'll just watch her when she orders a drink. I kind of get excited when she orders one. I tried to get her drunk one time. She will not sign up for that. I don't know what's... I can't even get her to dance on the table. She just won't. She won't go. She just... Because my sister, she's so bizarre when she starts to drink. First of all, it takes her a half hour to drink one drink. It's like it's evaporating right before your eyes. I mean, it's bizarre. And then she'll drink about half to two-thirds of the second drink, and I don't think she's ever finished one, very seldom finished a second drink. And she'll say the most peculiar thing you've ever heard. She'll say, "I don't want any more. I'm starting to feel it." I look at her and go, "Yeah?" She don't like it. She gets a feeling as she feels the effect of alcohol, like she's losing control. I get to the same place my sister gets to, where the effect starts to hit her and she goes, "Whoa." I get to that place and I go, "Oh yeah. Oh, come on." Because I get a feeling like I'm gaining control. It seems like everything that was secretly and vaguely missing in me starts to fill up. I get a feeling like I'm about to become whole and complete. And that's a very different reaction to alcohol. So when you, in that context, it sort of makes sense why normal drinkers who know us and love us watch us and are astounded by our behavior. Why we don't just drink, we're people who drink when we're drunk. Matter of fact, I do some of my best drinking when drunk. And they look at me like, and you hear them say things to you all the time like, "Bob, after what happened to you last month, you're doing this? Why don't you just have two, three, stop?" And I look at them have two or three, and I don't understand why they stop. Why are you stopping? My God, you're two or three drinks away from freaking heaven. What are you stopping for? But I don't have what they have, and they don't have what I got. We are very different. We are very different. Silkworth goes on to say these allergic types can never safely use alcohol in any form at all. And once having formed a habit and found they cannot break it, once having lost their self-confidence, their reliance upon things human, their problems pile up on them and become astonishingly difficult to solve. That is so true that so many of us come to AA and the problems are so overwhelming we can't see what's killing us. And so what happens is we start attacking the problems and we never touch the alcoholism. You know, there are times when the sun and the moon are in the sky at the exact same time. But when that happens, even though the moon has a greater pull and effect on the earth, when they're in the sky at the same time, you can't even see the moon because the sun is so glaring. And I can't see what's killing me, but I can see the problems. I can see that I'm on paper. I can see I've lost another job and I got nowhere to live. I can see she left me. I can see that I got some mental problems because I'm just a wacky in here. I can see that I don't feel right. But I can't see what's underneath all of that. We get hung up in the problems. And I become a problem fixer. And I relapse and relapse and relapse because I'm not doing anything about my alcoholism. The bottom of the page, Silkworth, and I'll talk about this for a couple minutes and turn it over to Katie. Silkworth talks about, for the first time, the real essence of alcoholism. What makes this a terminal disease? Do you know, if all there was to alcoholism was the phenomenon of craving, then we would send you through some kind of 30-day program
They would educate you beyond doubt till you were convinced that under you just don't take the first drink and you'd be good to go. You would have essentially acute alcoholism. Because you just make up your mind that you're never going to drink again and you'd be fine. Maybe you'd need a little reminder once in a while. Maybe hop into an AA meeting once a month to just kind of remind yourself that you're the guy that really shouldn't drink at all. Maybe you could put a little thing on your mirror that says, don't drink. So you'd see it every morning. And you'd be good to go. That Nancy Reagan thing would work for you. You know, just say no. But what is it about me? I can say no. I can say no, 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 and I'm not smoking nothing. No, no, no. Well, maybe one. And if you're a chronic alcoholic of my type with untreated alcoholism, there's a yes in every barrel of no's. Eventually. The question for me is if with untreated alcoholism, without this awakening, without these steps, without the fellowship, without this whole package of Alcoholics Anonymous, the question is not if I'm going to drink again. The question is when. And you can put a lot of stuff between you and the moment of when. Some guys do it for 20 years before they drink again. 20 years of never sponsoring anybody. 20 years of self-serving. 20 years of never making all their amends. And then you get to the end of that rope. Some guys can't go through 3 weeks without relapsing. That's the problem. If we could tell you how long your string is, then you'd say, well, I got 3 years and 47 days before I got to do any crap around here. And what would we do? We'd wait the 3 years and 46 days. You know, and that's the way we are. But you don't know where the string's going to run out. None of us do. You know, for over 31 years, I've been taking a meeting into a detox twice a week. I can't tell you how many, I would say probably over 1,000 at least, men and women who had had many years of sobriety and drank again. Do you know that to this day, I have never met anybody who a week or two before they drank again thought they were ever going to drink again? Matter of fact, most of them will tell you they thought they had it made. And then all of a sudden, one day, because of untreated alcoholism, the key turns. And what's that about? Well, at the bottom of this page, Silkworth starts to talk about this. He starts off by saying men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. Well, that's true for everybody. That's even true for my sister. She just likes a little bit of it. But I think it's more for me. I think somewhere inside myself, in the very core of my being, I don't just like the effect. I think I need the effect. Carl Jung, the great psychiatrist, in a letter to Bill Wilson, said as a result of working with Roland Hazard, many, many of us, he said he came to the conclusion that the alcoholic's thirst for alcohol isn't really a thirst for alcohol. Jung said he thought it was a low-level thirst of the alcoholic's being for wholeness, unity, or as a religious guy might say, union with God. I drank alcohol because the truth was I don't fit here. I can't get connected to nothing. Alcoholism's a lonely business. And there was a time in my early drinking where 5 or 6 drinks of alcohol would free me. The sensation, Silky says, is so elusive that while they admit it as injurious, they cannot after a time differentiate the true from the false. How many times do we say this time it'll be different? Yeah, it was worse. They cannot after a time differentiate the true from the false. To them, their alcoholic life seems the only normal one. Isn't that our big secret, that the only time I really felt normal was when alcohol really worked? I don't want to admit that to anybody. I don't want to admit how odd I feel sober. I don't want to tell you that I don't feel like you look. I don't feel normal sober. And then here's where he starts to talk. This is the first mention of what I've come to understand is some of the symptoms
of this malady, the spiritual malady of alcoholism. Now, Silky's talking about us when we stop drinking, and he says, this happens to me. That I become restless, irritable, and discontented. It doesn't say unless I drink again. Unless I can again experience the sense of ease and comfort, which I had once, 20 years old, found in taking a few drinks. Drinks that I'll see everybody else in the world at work and all the guys that are partying and have, that I'll see others take without any punishment, or as he says, with impunity. So what happens? For all practical purposes, my alcoholism starts where the bottle ends. I go through a detox, I swear to myself, and I mean it this time. Man, look what's happened to me. My God, I'm never going to touch that stuff again. And then this restless, irritable, and discontentness starts to wear on me day in and day out and week in and week out. And this restlessness, this inability to really feel settled anywhere. You know, I'm a dog circling the room looking for a spot to lay down, and I can't find my spot. This irritability. I don't want to admit that I'm irritable, because the truth is I don't like irritable people. And I'm not irritable. But when I get sober, I can't help it if I just see so clearly how stupid everybody is. I'm not irritable. You're an idiot. And everybody rubs life, and people rub me the wrong way. I'm a smart guy when I get sober. Smart because I know what's wrong with everybody. Some of you know exactly what I'm talking about. Go to work, nice job. Not even there 3 weeks, and you start noticing the idiots show up, don't they? The stupid people show up. And they don't listen, they don't mind. I'm irritable, and I'm discontent. My God, I stopped drinking. There's some kind of vacancy, something missing in my life. And I don't know what it is, but whatever it is, this vacant, this vacuum is driving on me. And so I just immediately start targeting things that I think are going to make a difference. Man, that motorcycle. The one in the magazine. Man, if I had that, I had a chopper like that. That guitar. Man, if I had a Les Paul. Whoa, that girl. Oh, my God. If I was with her, pigeons would fly out my ears. Oh, my God. That job in the steel mill. Oh my, that's buy a house, own a boat kind of money. My God, I'd be somebody then. And then what happens? We're clever people. We are clever people. We'll maneuver and we'll get whatever that was. Did you ever notice how you get it? How come the shine of it wears off so quickly for me? You know, you're with that girl that you knew was going to change your life, and you're not even with her very long. It's like, God, I was wrong about her. That job, making that big money in that steel mill. And my God, they're stupid and they're taking advantage of me. Jeez. And Chuck Chamberlain, one of my great mentors, said, if you be alcoholic and you're sober, there'll eventually come a time where you can no longer put anything between you and you. And there you are. And there you are. And what does Silkworth say happens then? He says they succumb to the desire to drink again, as so many do. And what happens? The phenomenon of craving develops. And I pass through the well-known stages of a spree. I burn my life down again. Because if you're an alcoholic like me, you pick up a drink, it's like having sex with a gorilla. You ain't done till the gorilla's done. You can tell yourself all night long, me and the gorilla are going to have a dance. No, you're not. No, you're not. And I burn my life to the ground again and again. And again and again, and I can't stop the process. Can you take me off to it?
Oh, good. Great job, Bob. Katie, alcoholic.
Hey, Katie.
The doctor's opinion is one of my favorites. I can tie a lot of this into untreated alcoholism. As much as Bob did such a beautiful job of explaining it for the new guy, I can tie it into someone sitting there with 15 years sober that doesn't have much of a program, not realizing that the allergy's just sitting there waiting. And one of the things that I think tends to happen, and the explanation is beautiful, it's exactly the same. Just put your circumstance in there, and it says the same lines that Bob said, as we believe and so suggested a few years ago, that the actions of alcohol on these chronic alcoholics is a manifestation of an allergy. That allergy, when you have been removed from the drink, it's about a 7-day process. That's a detox. And then the allergy is fine. However, if you have the malady, you're walking around with the malady and you don't know it, and say the doctor says, wow, you need a root canal, you're going to have a little bit of Vicodin. Is that okay? Oh, yeah. Yeah. I got a lot of problems going on because my problems are astonishingly piling up in sobriety. And that Vicodin, I might need that. So you take the Vicodin, and it triggers the allergy. And all of a sudden, you need 3 more pills. And then before you know it, you're rescheduling more dental work. And that's how that deal works, right? See, that allergy is still sitting there. It doesn't go away. It's what Bob said, if we're removed from it for 7 days, if that was the only problem with alcoholism, just remove me from the drink, and I'll be fine. And we lose a lot of people in the program to pills. And that usually is how it happens. You blow your knee out on a motorcycle accident, or heck, stepping off a curb at our age can blow a knee out, can it? Get you a pair of bifocals and you're like, whoa, what happened? But it is so, so important to not lose sight of the fact that this allergy is just not for the new guy. This allergy is everybody who sits in this room, right? And one of the things that I love about this, and I go out to a lot of treatment centers, and I love the way that the Dr. Silkworth lays this out, because it's absolutely wonderful. If you're on page XXVIII, and you come down to the part where two paragraphs down, thought the emotional appeal seldom suffice. The message which can interest and hold these alcoholic people must have depth and weight. Well, one of the things is if you've ever been sitting in AA meetings and you're wondering why people are not asking you to sponsor, it may be because your program does not have depth and weight. You know, you're not the person who is knee-deep in the work and knee-deep in the book, and you're seeing this entire psychic change take place. And I think one of the greatest gifts about that is the level of depth and weight that Bob has is very attractive to me. I like the message he brings. It speaks to my soul. That's what depth and weight looks like, is when somebody sits here and you go, my God, they're talking to me. They're talking about my life. And I think we've all experienced that in AA. And that's one of the beauties of meetings, is that you get to hear somebody and you get that feeling where you need to go over there to them and talk to them. And that only happens with another drunk. Doesn't happen with the psychiatrist, doesn't happen with the counselor, doesn't happen with your mother or your sister. But you get another drunk and you don't even have to know them, and that level of depth and weight is what we're talking about. And to have this doctor understand all of this, to me, is so divinely inspired. And then it says, you know, as it continues on, the other part I love about this is where it says men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. I mean, I like strawberry shortcake a lot. I could eat it before every meal. But I love the effect produced by alcohol. And one of the things that I didn't get, and once again, it's like what Bob was saying, is, said, I didn't get the lingo that we hear today that we take for granted, right? The malady, restless, irritable, and discontent, and the allergy, and the manifestation. And, you know, I mean, when you were sitting in your first few AA meetings, were you like going, what? A manifestation of what? You know, and what is a malady? Heck, I didn't even know what the word serenity meant, you know? And that's what happens to us when we're sitting there. So we kind of lose sight of all of this terminology. But when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, when it says men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol, I had no idea that when I took my first drink, that it fixed that malady. Okay, now I didn't know that. All I knew is, oh, we're going to do this a lot. This is great. And then what ended up happening is I overshot the mark so badly. Of course, I went into a ton of outside issues because I found the more cocaine I did, the more I could drink. And as a woman, the longer I could drink without being a blackout, stumbling drunk. And that was very important to kind of protect myself in the environments I was putting myself in. And so when that got out of hand, I surely thought it was the alcohol. I mean, wouldn't anyone who was watching my life? It's the alcohol that's the problem. And so if you people in AA can get me removed from the alcohol, I'm fine from here. I really got it from here. And for the longest time, that's what I believed the problem was. I had no idea that the problem was a level of self that we'll talk more about in the third step, but that's the restless, irritable, and discontented. I had no idea that that's what that drink was taking care of. And so by the time the drinking got so totally out of hand, and my problem seemed astonishingly difficult to solve, it was because of alcohol. Everyone around me said the same thing. Your family, stop drinking. It's your problems. Nobody ever said, you were a pain in the ass from the minute you came out of the womb. Would you agree? Oh, yeah. I mean, if we lined up the school teachers and the principals and your neighbors, and they wouldn't go, oh, that Katie, God love her. She was just there for everybody. You know, she was the one burning down the school. She broke my banana tree. She stole my kid's bike. You know what I mean? And so that's what I'm talking about is this when drugs and alcohol got a hold of me, I thought they were the problem. So when you removed, when I got sober, I was like, wow, thank you. I got it from here. Man. Because my level of self, like Bob said, we're crafty. I can get anything I want. I absolutely can. If I told you in a month I'd be standing behind Obama, you'd be shocked in a month when you went, well, I'll be damned. I believe that's that chick right there. Told you. Right? Because we're crafty people. We can do, and all of a sudden then, you know, when it talks about our problems are astonishingly difficult to solve. Man, we blow up the world when we blow it up, don't we? We're like, we just bring the whole thing down with us. It's like we have a net, you know, we just bring it on in. And that's the difference. Besides the fact we are body and physically different, right? Our entire body, our mind, everything about us is different. And I don't know about you, but that was great news for me. When the book says that we are outright mental defects, now, tell me if this doesn't make you feel good. Maladjusted to life, full flight from reality, outright mental defects. To me, I was like, oh my God, I love that. Because that's how I always felt. I never felt a part of it. And you could never make me feel a part of. But if we sat around and drank enough, I always felt a part of. Right? I always felt like the life of the party, and it was great, and I could just, it was just all there. So when I really did start to get into the book, I went, my gosh, you know, they have so written a book about me. That in itself blew me away. Well, when it says, then, I love the line, then they cannot after a time differentiate the true from the false. Their alcoholic life seems the only normal one. Well, what ends up happening is, you know, you're tooling along, and you manage to get through school, and you do the things that are necessary, expected of you under the name of potential, and, you know, you try to stay out of jail, and you try not to get in trouble, what have you. And then all of a sudden, you know, it starts getting messy. Wouldn't you agree? And then it gets messier. And then all of a sudden, the next thing you know, you got a little bit of legal problems. And then you got a PO. Then you got a DWI. And then you have to do a UA. Now, in here, that's normal terminology, wouldn't it? Well, you sit around a dinner party with people that are non-alcoholic. So when was the last time you got a DWI? Yeah. Wait, who's your PO? Have you had to have a UA lately? And people are like going, what is a UA? Have you ever had anybody, you know, say, what is AA? You know, the world doesn't really get us anyway. And we lose sight in these rooms that our alcoholic life seems the only normal one. I mean, sometimes we'll be out in the world and I'll be with some newcomers that are talking terribly in the grocery store. And I'm like, yo, whoa, whoa. Mixed nay on the yo nay man. And I mean, they're cussing and they're like, whoa. There are people all around and you're talking about, you know, whatever. See, that our alcoholic life seems the only normal one. We lose perspective very quickly. One of the things that it made me think of was talking about losing perspective when Bob was saying that the world doesn't get us, right? The way we drink, it doesn't get us. We in AA don't get the guy that goes out and drinks. How many times are we shocked when somebody we sponsored drinks? And what is the question we ask them? Same question everybody else asked. Why'd you do that? That's what I do. Right? And it's unbelievable how we can lose perspective with our own people. Right? You got to start nodding your head or something. There you go. I'm worried about it there, Bob. But the truth is that, you know, you get the new guy. This book is, you know, Silkworth is explaining it beautifully. And they're 18 days sober and you're shocked that they went out and drank again. Myself included. You know, and I have to get myself reminded. Beyond human aid. Ooh, wow. You know, and so I was taking some notes over here while Bob was talking. And the other thing about the allergy that I love is, you know, the allergy manifests as a phenomenon of craving. That's really big words for the new guy. It really, really is. Especially if you do a lot of work with new guys. I mean, they're just looking at you with a blank, huh? You know, and so I break it down as the allergy to cats. The way the allergy manifests is itchy eyes, scratchy throat, right? You nose clogs. It doesn't matter if you're allergic to cats. If it's a tomcat or a Persian, it's a cat, right? So when you're talking to a new guy, we're talking about the allergy. I'm not going to be in the crosshairs of if it's alcohol or drugs or anti-anxiety or whatever. It's going to trigger the allergy, period. And you're with me on that, yeah? And that's the part when we sometimes expect the guy to sit in AA and begin to understand the allergy. It is our job and our responsibility to pull that new guy out of the room and explain the allergy. And then we can move into the rest of it, but not the war story, right? I mean, the war story ends up, it's like we're going to scare him into AA. Well, heck, somebody can get a DWI. That doesn't make them alcoholic. I need to find out if they got the allergy. When you start drinking, can you stop? Now, here's what I thought happened to me, is I thought I just changed my mind. How many of y'all are, you know what, I got an hour. I'll just have a couple of drinks. There you go. Ooh. Okay, I got another 30 minutes. And then you get to the point to where you're in trouble already. Who cares? Right? You've already crossed the line. You're in trouble. See, I always thought I just changed my mind because I was having fun. I have no idea the allergy took me. And see, when you start talking to the new guy knee to knee, that depth and weight is what we're talking about, they start going, oh my God, they really start getting it. I'm a big fan of taking the new guy out of the room. When they're in the room, because I want to do that eye to eye thing with them and get that aha. And the restless, irritable, and discontented, right? And one other thing about to them, their alcoholic life seems the only normal one. When you work with a lot of new guys, it does surprise me when I'm in the treatment centers I go every week and I am like Bob, I'm a big fan of working with another drunk, is to them, subsidized housing, government money, welfare is pretty normal. That's their way of life. And I asked him, when did you make that decision? When you were 16 years old and you wanted the hopes and dreams of life, did you expect it to be the government check? Did you expect it to be food stamps, Section 8 housing, which is always right next to the crack house, right? And you can just see the look on their face, because to them at the treatment center, when they say, hey, the government's here to take your application, they'll fly out of my meeting. Like, great. I can't work against the government cash. Right? I'm just the girl trying to carry the hope of AA. You know how they are, that new guy. La, 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 la. So when they come back in, they usually get a good tongue lashing from me on the government, relying so strongly on the government. But sometimes they don't get that. It talks about the entire psychic change. I think the other beauty behind that word, and a lot of the terminology in the book is psychic change also spiritual experience, spiritual awakening? Well, I'm not in here to split hairs with you, whatever you want on that one. But I do believe the powerful word there is entire. I had a psychic change when the compulsion to drink was removed. No doubt about it. I remember it clear as day. It was about 90 days sober. Back in the 80s, Takati, Your Body was a hot advertisement. And I remember driving by a billboard, seeing that, and it was like 7 o'clock at night, and I thought, oh my God, I have not thought about drinking all day. It was the first day I'd gone all day without, and I'd been doing AA, and all of a sudden, it was about 90 days. I made a mental note. Now, that to me is a psychic change. When he talks about an entire psychic change, my sponsor likes to look at that as a big pie. And she says, the compulsion to drink is just a little sliver. But the book talks about us growing in understanding and effectiveness, in growing in this spiritual development, which begins, as far as I'm concerned, as I'm working towards an entire psychic change. And the promises in the book continue to tell me what they look like. Peace of mind, calamity with serenity, position of neutrality. So I believe right there when he talks about an entire psychic change, right, it's on page XXIX, it says, the next paragraph down, on the other hand, and strange as it may seem to those who do not understand, once a psychic change has occurred, he just told you, right, just a psychic change, not an entire psychic change. And to me, I believe this book was so divinely inspired that it is important that it be studied. And it'd be studied in the depth of the word. Now, you don't have to go hog wild and crazy and beat somebody if they disagree with you. But it's for your own development. And that was when my sponsor pointed that out, I thought, well, I'll be darned. That does say that entire psychic change. It says, once he's had a psychic change, it's an interesting concept to ponder. I'll let God work the rest of the work with me. And so, the other thing I wanted to talk about too, and I, like I said, I made some notes on Bob's thing, is the drug of choice. You know, sometimes in meetings, and don't get me wrong, I absolutely love AA. I love the AA fellowship. I love AA meetings. But sometimes you hear something in a meeting, and after you hear it three times, you think it's the truth, right? And we lose sight. The new guy is learning and developing. And this is our watch, right? This is our watch for our kids and our children's children, that we must make sure that we keep that on the right path, shall I say, in AA. Wouldn't you agree? If you want this baby to be around in 100 years, and the term drug of choice is lobbed around, I think it's important to clear that up. I have no choice in drugs. I mean, I know what I like, but I'll do whatever you got. Right? You lob out anything, and I'm like, what's that one? What's that one? I don't know that I ever said, oh no, I'm waiting for my drug of choice to come along. Thank you. Put all that back in your pocket, I'll be fine. I mean, there is no choice. We have lost the power of choice. That's a powerful word that's been brought into AA. And I think it's just important that, gently be teaching that, right? That's the beauty of these things, is when you hear somebody say drug of choice, I like to always clear it up. I'm a good clearer-upper in AA. You know, real good clearer-upper. But I like it, and one of the other things that Bob and I have done, the first time I ever met Bob, I've met, there's a lot of people in AA that I really admire, longer-term sobriety, really deep into the AA program, and one of the things I love about Bob is his level of growing in understanding and effectiveness. He has such a beautiful way of teaching the book on such a level that I don't get defensive at all. And I don't know about you, but I am one contempt prior to investigation person. You know what I mean? You go against anything, and I've slammed the door, bolted it, locked it, and your lips are moving, and I'm hearing nothing. And he's got such a fabulous way of growing and understanding and effectiveness, and I love that. So I always ask in prayer when somebody says drug of choice or lobs out a one-liner that makes me crazy, I say, God, help me grow in understanding and effectiveness so I can go help this person see this differently. Because I got to teach one person at a time that they have it prepared for my children's children's children, right? So one thing is don't let's not louse this deal up, right? Well, one of the other deals, too, is that the terminology that we use in AA, it does kind of crack me up. Could you ever see yourself walking into the bar? And I mean, didn't you just feel comfortable at the bar? I mean, don't you feel comfortable at the coffee bar? You know, anything that's got a drink and a ledge. I just kind of want to belly up to it, you know? And I want to stand there. If I don't know anybody, it's a brand new meet, I just want to stand at the coffee pot. You know, and people come up, I go, how you doing? The feeling in here is still that feeling of the bar to me, just sober. And we pass the basket, so it looks a little like drug money, you know, when you get it all. I mean, it's kind of a funny deal we got going here. But you never walked into the bar and said, God Almighty Joe, I've had the malady all over me all day. I tell you what, and I'm going to order me a drink because I got the mental obsession. I know it's going to trigger the allergy, but set me one up right here. I mean, that's just not how we thought. That's what was happening. But that's not at all what we realized, which is kind of funny when you think of it that way because it makes total sense that that's what's going on. Is as the day went on, I began in the later part of my drinking to start, you know, putting Kahlua in my coffee. That was big. I had a child, I had a job. I was trying desperately to maintain. And at 26, I got sober. And I'm very, very grateful I didn't go any further down than I went down. But it was very bad as far as I was concerned. And what other thing was I going to say? Bob, I think I'm done.
Let's take a 9-minute and 14-second break.